Chapter 10. Plate, a lackey in attendance, and a gratifying nice pail or two of champagne to eager the supper. It was no small cost to serve 500 people on silver, and the repast was certainly a princely and magnificent one. I had, of course, arranged with Mademoiselle de Schlippenschlipp, Captains Frumpel and Friedelberger of the Duke's Guard, Mesdames de Butterbrod and Bob, formed our little party. The first course, of course, consisted of the oysters. Attilia's eyes gleamed with double brilliance as the lackey opened them. There were 9 apiece for us, how well I recollect the number. I never was much of an oyster eater, nor can I relish them in naturalibus as some do, but require a quantity of sauces, lemons, cayenne peppers, bread and butter, and so forth, to render them palatable. By the time I had made my preparations, Attilia, the captains, and the 2 ladies, had well nigh finished theirs. Indeed, Attilia had gobbled up all hers, and there were only my 9 in the dish. I took one that was bad. The scent of it was enough, they were all bad. Attilia had eaten 9 bad oysters. I put down the horrid shell. Her eyes glistened more and more, she could not take them off the tray. Dear Herr George, she said, will you give me your oysters? As he had them all down before I could say Jack Robinson. I left Kalbsbrücken that night, and have never been there since. Fitzpoodle's professions. Being appeals to the unemployed younger sons of the nobility. First profession. The fair and honest proposition in which I offered to communicate privately with parents and guardians, relative to 2 new and lucrative professions which I had discovered, has, I find from the publisher, elicited not one single inquiry from those personages, who I can't but think are very little careful of their children's welfare, to allow such a chance to be thrown away. It is not for myself I speak, as my conscience proudly tells me, for though I actually gave a basket in order to be in the way should any father of a family be inclined to treat with me regarding my discoveries, yet I am grieved, not on my own account, but on theirs, and for the wretched penny-wise policy that has held them back. That they must feel an interest in my announcement is unquestionable. Look at the way in which the public prints of all parties have noticed my appearance in the character of a literary man. Putting aside my personal narrative, look at the offer I made to the nation, a choice of no less than 2 new professions. Suppose I had invented as many new kinds of butcher's meat. Does anyone pretend that the world, tired as it is of the perpetual recurrence of beef, mutton, veal, cold beef, cold veal, cold mutton, hash ditto, would not have jumped eagerly at the delightful intelligence that their old stale stupid meals were about to be varied at last? Of course people would have come forward. I should have had deputations from Mr. Giblets and the fashionable butchers of this world. Petitions would have poured in from Whitechapel salesmen, the speculators panting to know the discovery, the cautious with stock in hand eager to bribe me to silence and prevent the certain depreciation of the goods which they already possessed. I should have dealt with them, not greedily or rapaciously, but on honest principles of fair barter. Gentlemen, I should have said, or rather, gents which affectionate diminutive is, I am given to understand, at present much in use among commercial persons gents, my researches, my genius, or my good fortune, have brought me to the valuable discovery about which you are come to treat. Will you purchase it outright, or will you give the discoverer an honest share of the profits resulting from your speculation? My position in the world puts me out of the power of executing the vast plan I have formed, but 'twill be a certain fortune to him who engages in it, and why should not I too participate in that fortune? Such would have been my manner of dealing with the world too, with regard to my discovery of the new professions. Does not the world want new professions? Are there not thousands of well-educated men panting, struggling, pushing, starving, in the old ones? Grim tenants of chambers looking out for attorneys who never come? Wretched physicians practicing the stale joke of being called out of church until people no longer think fit, even to laugh or to pity. Are there not hoary-headed midshipmen, antique ensigns growing moldy upon 50 years' half pay? Nay, are there not men who would pay anything to be employed, rather than remain idle? But such is the glut of professionals, the horrible cutthroat competition among them, that there is no chance for one in 1,000, be he ever so willing, or brave, or clever. In the great ocean of life he makes a few strokes, and puffs, and sputters, and sinks, and the innumerable waves overwhelm him, and he is heard of no more. Walking to my banker's t'other day, and I pledge my sacred honor this story is true, I met a young fellow whom I had known attaché to an embassy abroad, a young man of tolerable parts, unwearied patience, with some fortune too, and, moreover, allied to a noble Whig family, whose interest had procured him his appointment to the legation at Kerwinkle, where I knew him. He remained for 10 years a diplomatic character. He was the working man of the legation. He sent over the most diffuse translations of the German papers for the use of the foreign secretary. He signed passports with most astonishing ardor. He exiled himself for 10 long years in a wretched German town, dancing attendance at court balls and paying no end of money for uniforms. And what for? At the end of the 10 years, during which period of labor he never received a single shilling from the government which employed him, rascally spendthrift of a government, he was offered the paid attaché ship to the court of H.M. the King of the Mosquito Islands, and refused that appointment a week before the Whig ministry retired. Then he knew that there was no further chance for him, and incontinently quitted the diplomatic service forever, and I have no doubt will sell his uniform a bargain. The government had him a bargain certainly, nor is he by any means the first person who has been sold at that price. Well, my worthy friend met me in the street, and informed me of these facts with a smiling countenance, which I thought a masterpiece of diplomacy. Fortune had been belaboring and kicking him for 10 whole years, and here he was grinning in my face. Could Monsieur de Talleyrand have acted better? Have given up diplomacy, said Protocol, quite simply and good-humoredly, for between you and me, my good fellow, it's a very slow profession. Sure, perhaps, but slow. But though I gained no actual pecuniary remuneration in the service, I have learned all the languages in Europe, which will be invaluable to me in my new profession, the mercantile one in which directly I looked out for a post I found one. What? And a good pay? Said I, why, no, that's absurd, you know. No young men, strangers to business, are paid much to speak of. Besides, I don't look to a paltry clerk's pay. Some day, when thoroughly acquainted with the business, I shall learn it in about 7 years. I shall go into a good house with my capital, and become junior partner. And meanwhile? Meanwhile I conduct the foreign correspondence of the eminent house of Jam, Ram, and Johnson, and very heavy it is, I can tell you. From 9 till 6 every day, except foreign post days, and then from 9 till 11. Dirty dark court to sit in, snobs to talk to, great change, as you may fancy. And you do all this for nothing? I do it to learn the business. And so saying, Protocol gave me a knowing nod, and went his way. Good heavens! I thought, and is this a true story? Are there hundreds of young men in a similar situation at the present day, giving away the best years of their youth for the sake of a mere windy hope of something in old age, and dying before they come to the goal? In 7 years he hopes to have a business, and then to have the pleasure of risking his money? He will be admitted into some great house as a particular favor, and 3 months after the house will fail. Has it not happened to 1,000 of our acquaintance? I thought I would run after him, and tell him about the new professions that I have invented. Oh, eh. Those you wrote about in Fraser's magazine. Egad. George, necessity makes strange fellows of us all. Who would ever have thought of you spelling, much more writing? Never mind that. Will you, if I tell you of a new profession that, with a little cleverness and instruction from me, you may bring to a most successful end, will you, I say, make me a fair return? My dear creature, replied young Protocol, what nonsense you talk! I saw that very humbug in the magazine. You say you have made a great discovery, very good. You puff your discovery, very right. You ask money for it, nothing can be more reasonable. And then you say, that you intend to make your discovery public in the next number of the magazine. Do you think I will be such a fool, as to give you money for a thing which I can have next month for nothing? Goodbye, George my boy, the next discovery you make I'll tell you, how to get a better price for it. And with this the fellow walked off, looking supremely knowing and clever. This tale of the person I have called Protocol is not told without a purpose, you may be sure. In the first place, it shows what are the reasons that nobody has made application to me concerning the new professions, namely, because I have passed my word to make them known in this magazine, which persons may have for the purchasing, stealing, borrowing, or hiring, and, therefore, they will never think of applying personally to me. And, secondly, his story proves also my assertion, viz., that all professions are most cruelly crowded at present, and that men will make the most absurd outlay and sacrifices for the smallest chance of success at some future period. Well, then, I will be a benefactor to my race, if I cannot be to one single member of it, whom I love better than most men. What I have discovered I will make known. There shall be no shilly-shallying work here, no circumlocution, no bottle-conjuring business. But oh, I wish for all our sakes that I had had an opportunity to impart the secret to one or two persons only, for, after all, but one or two can live in the manner I would suggest. And when the discovery is made known, I am sure 10,000 will try. The rascals! I can see their brass plates gleaming over scores of doors. Competition will ruin my professions, as it has all others. It must be premised that the two professions are intended for gentlemen, and gentlemen only, men of birth and education. No others could support the parts which they will be called upon to play. And, likewise, it must be honestly confessed that these professions have, to a certain degree, been exercised before. Do not cry out at this, and say it is no discovery. I say it is a discovery. It is a discovery, if I show you a gentleman a profession which you may exercise without derogation, or loss of standing, with certain profit, nay, possibly with honor, and of which, until the reading of this present page, you never thought, but as of a calling beneath your rank and quite below your reach. Sir, I do not mean to say that I create a profession. I cannot create gold, but if, when discovered, I find the means of putting it in your pocket, do I or do I not deserve credit? I see you sneer contemptuously when I mention to you the word auctioneer. Is this all, you say, that this fellow brags and prates about? An auctioneer, forsooth! He might as well have invented chimney sweeping. No such thing. A little boy of 7, be he ever so low of birth, can do this as well as you. Do you suppose that little stolen Master Montague made a better sweeper than the lowest bred chummy that yearly commemorates his release? No, sir. And he might have been ever so much a genius or gentleman, and not have been able to make his trade respectable. But all such trades as can be rendered decent the aristocracy has adopted one by one. At first they followed the profession of arms, flouting all others as unworthy, and thinking it ungentlemanlike to know how to read or write. They did not go into the church in very early days, till the money to be got from the church was strong enough to tempt them. It is but of later years that they have condescended to go to the bar, and since the same time, only that we see some of them following trades. I know an English lord's son, who is, or was, a wine merchant. He may have been a bankrupt for what I know. As for bankers, several partners in banking houses have four balls to their coronets, And I have no doubt that another sort of banking, viz., that practiced by gentlemen who lend small sums of money upon deposited securities, will be one day followed by the noble order, so that they may have four balls on their coronets and carriages, and three in front of their shops. Yes, the nobles come peoplewards as the people, on the other hand, rise and mingle with the nobles. With the plebs, of course, Fitzboodle, in whose veins flows the blood of 1,000 kings, can have nothing to do, but, watching the progress of the world, 'tis impossible to deny that the good old days of our race are passed away. We want money still as much as ever we did, but we cannot go down from our castles with horse and sword and waylay fat merchants. No, no, confounded new policemen and the assize courts prevent that. Younger brothers cannot be pages to noble houses, as of old they were, serving gentle dames without disgrace, handing my lord's rose water to wash, or holding his stirrup as he mounted for the chase. A page, forsooth. A pretty figure would George Fitzboodle, or any other man of fashion, cut, in a jacket covered with sugar loaf buttons, and handing in penny post notes on a silver tray. The plebs have robbed us of that trade among others. Nor, I confess, do I much grudge them their travail. Neither can we collect together a few scores of free lances, like honest Hugh Caverly in the Black Prince's time, or brave Harry Butler of Wallenstein's dragoons, and serve this or that prince, Peter the Cruel or Henry of Trastamer, Gustavus or the Emperor, at our leisure. Or, in default of service, fight and rob on our own gallant account, as the good gentlemen of old did. Alas! No. In South America or Texas, perhaps, a man might have a chance that way, but in the ancient world no man can fight except in the king's service, and a mighty bad service that is too, and the lowest European sovereign, were it Baldomero Espartero himself, would think nothing of seizing the best-born condottier that ever drew sword, and shooting him down like the vulgarest deserter. What, then, is to be done? We must discover fresh fields of enterprise, of peaceable and commercial enterprise in a peaceful and commercial age. I say, then, that the auctioneer's pulpit has never yet been ascended by a scion of the aristocracy, and am prepared to prove that they might scale it, and do so with dignity and profit. For the auctioneer's pulpit is just the peculiar place where a man of social refinement, of elegant wit, of polite perceptions, can bring his wit, his eloquence, his taste, and his experience of life most delightfully into play. It is not like the bar, where... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.